Every Friday on the Monocle Arts Review, we look ahead to the weekend with a What's On guide to the cinema. And judging by the weather here in London, it does look like it might be a good couple of days for the box office. Joining me here in the studio today is film critic Jason Solomons, who's picked a trio of films that take us from arthouse brain benders to alien attack blockbusters, with a few extra large diamonds thrown in for good measure. And later on the show, we'll head to the Sonar Festival in Barcelona to discuss the state of virtual reality technology. All that coming up on the Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Rylan. We'll begin today's show with Omar Fast's adaptation of Tom McCarthy's novel Remainder. In this, our nameless protagonist, played by Tom Sturridge, spends a $10 million payout after an accident trying to meticulously reenact the series of events that led him to being struck by some heavy debris. Here's a clip.
About the past.
Is that you?
I can say very little.
By signing this document, you agree not to discuss the accident in public, essentially.
I have to forget it ever happened, legally speaking. Something fell down from the sky, and then nothing.
Keep thinking you don't even remember me.
I have big gaps, but some things are starting to come back.
Like what?
A clip there from Remainder. Jason, welcome to the show. Now, Omar Fast, this is his feature debut. He's better known as an artist. How do you think that really resonates in the film?
Yeah, I think Omar Fast is an Israeli sort of installation artist in a way, has worked with video as well as sculpture. And this is exactly what this film is about. It's about a man trying to sculpt something out of his past, a memory, and put something together. It's very much an urban landscape that he's trying to control and build together with this kind of limitless pot of money. And I thought this was terrific, actually. It's kind of sci-fi, but it's set here and now. I'm not a big sci-fi fan, actually. I like this sort of sci-fi, though, which is kind of that here and now. It's about how we control ourselves in the urban environment. Can we do it? He tries to make things happen exactly. It's about recreating a moment. And can we possibly do that in its exactitude? I mean, there's a great bit where he kind of gets annoyed with the birds because they won't kind of bend to his kind of, you know, his and the cats, because they won't do exactly how, you know, what he wants them to do and control them. You can't wrangle reality. That's what this film's about.
I was having a chat to one of the stars of this, Arsha Ali. He plays the role of Naz. We were talking about how the concept of memories and recreating memories, by their nature, memories are quite unreliable, aren't they? So I think it's interesting in this film, the visual style seems to play on that in an interesting way. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, from the beginning, you talk about debris. It's sort of, it's one of those glass and steel structures in the city that sort of comes down and injures this man. Instantly, it kind of makes you think about reflections and refractions and what memory does. There's a shattering at the start of this film of glass, and it really is about the shattering of a reality and a consciousness. And can you piece that back together? A memory will be very selective about it, and I think that's what Omar Fast is going for here. I think it's a very interesting sphere for this artist to be working in, the feature film. I think he does it very boldly and confidently. It is, as you saw, a brain bender at the beginning of the show, and I don't normally like having my mind bent by movies and Escher drawings and things like this. Not because I'm after simplicity, I just sometimes think that movies can get lost in themselves on this one, and I think he's got a very strong line throughout Remainder as well, helped by the performance, I think, of Tom Sturridge, an actor who I sometimes sort of have difficulty getting in. He's a very hooded sort of actor.
It's an interesting point, actually. Just quickly, I wanted to get your thoughts on that, because Tom Sturridge in this film, he's not exactly likeable, is he? And that's obviously intentional in his part, but that can be problematic sometimes when you're watching a film whose the main character that's supposed to be taking you through is really not someone you want to spend any time with whatsoever.
Absolutely. He's a control freak. He's unlikable on screen. He's a power controller. But in the end, you're on his side as well, because you feel that you want this thing to come together. We're all, as audiences, willing for this puzzle to come together. Yes. So you're kind of on his side in that respect. I thought it was very, very smart, Remainder. I was much more impressed with it than I thought I was going to be.
Definitely one to watch out for. And also tune into the cinema show a little bit later today. That's at 20:00 London time. I'll be having that chat with one of the stars of Remainder, Arsha Ali. Remainder is out in UK and German cinemas from today. Now, next up, we have a documentary all about jewellery makers, Tiffany & Co., of course, and how they evolved from one shop to a global brand. This film is called Crazy About Tiffany's, and it's directed by Matthew Miele. Jason, would this appeal to anyone who's not really a fan of the jewellery store itself?
I think it's trying to appeal to people who like Breakfast at Tiffany's and Audrey Hepburn fans. Yes. I think there's a bit of social retail history in there. I mean, you know, Tiffany in New York, they call it the little shop on the corner. It occupies this, you know, extraordinary place on Fifth Avenue in both popular and cultural and real estate kind of history.
Though oddly smaller than it appears in the film, I have to say.
Absolutely. It looks like it's the most enormous place in the world. And it's not, you know, I suppose it's like opening a Tiffany box, this movie. You just kind of, it all looks bright and nice and blue and that beautiful Pantone shade and the white ribbon. I mean, I think the film would have you kind of wrap the world up in a blue box with a white ribbon. Maybe you should hire Christo, the installation artist, to kind of do it. I'm not really sure what this was about. It's very unusual because I thought it might be about exploring where diamonds come from. There's a sort of hint when the big Tiffany diamond itself is discovered in the Kimberley mine in South Africa that we might go down there and kind of see what, you know, what's going on in the Earth's core for diamonds. No, it doesn't do anything like that. It wants to concentrate on how beautiful Jessica Biel's neck looks on Oscar night.
What is with that? I mean, I have to ask you, what's Jessica Biel doing in this film?
Showing off and getting people to go, gorgeous, amazing. I actually really quite enjoyed watching it. It's so camp and upscale and sort of oblivious to reality, with Baz Luhrmann in there talking about Great Gatsby and the sort of the blue book, the catalogue that they have for this Tiffany. It's got this kind of wonderful people called Muffy or Fluffy or something like that. I don't know if it's the woman or the dog, those kind of ladies who lunch. We hear a bit of Elaine Stritch's kind of anthem come through there. And it's about this kind of consumer society, I think it's a little bit about that, and yet it wants to put you off. I mean, you know, is Tiffany the world's leading diamond brand? I mean, this film would have you believe it so, but I've been into Tiffany. I mean, it's a load of old toot that you can get in a market.
There's a lot of history behind Tiffany's. I know that they made, I think it was swords during the American Civil War, a really odd piece of trivia there. How much do you get of that kind of bizarre history walking back through the story behind Tiffany's?
You get a little bit of the presidents who've bought Tiffany for their wife, like Jackie O has worn some, and Mrs. Lincoln, I think, worn some maybe to the theatre on that fateful night. I think she was wearing Tiffany. There's someone had a Tiffany watch. Not enough. To kind of sustain the documentary. I couldn't really work out what Matthew Miele was going for as a director. He did Scatter My Ashes at Bergdorf's.
Exactly, which was
this.
I watched that, and that's a very fascinating film. Although it's not something I would go to the cinema for. It's a lazy day in front of Netflix. It's not something you pay for.
He's doing all of Fifth Avenue. I don't know where he's going to go next.
All of Fifth Avenue.
Well, I mean, you've got Tiffany, and then you've got Bergdorf's, and then where next? The Apple Store.
Oh dear. Okay, that's Crazy About Tiffany's. It came out earlier this year in the United States, where it's available on iTunes. It's in UK theatres today. Well, if big diamonds aren't your thing, then maybe big blockbusters are. Our next film is Independence Day Resurgence, the sequel to the 1996 film that saw Will Smith go up against the aliens. Jason, there's no Will Smith in this second film. This time, Liam Hemsworth takes up the lead role. Sort of reminds me of that time that Keanu Reeves mysteriously disappeared from the sequel to Speed and was replaced by the rather ill-fitting Jason Patrick.
Yeah, and Kristen Stewart recently disappeared from the Snow White sequel as well.
What's going on? Where are they all going?
Well, some stars know where their bread is best buttered, I think.
Let's get ourselves into the mood first, though, with this clip.
I spent 20 years trying to get us ready for this. We used their technology to strengthen our planet. But it won't be enough.
I see them in my dreams. They're coming back.
Oh dear, that sounds rather alarming. Now, so many sequels this year that nobody wants to see. We've had that Ninja Turtles disaster and that Batman vs. Superman, arguably also a disaster. Is this one any different?
20 years for Roland Emmerich to kind of do a follow-up. I mean, obviously now, when a film, this was the biggest movie of 1996, when that happens in Hollywood now, the sequel is rushed out, not 20 years. What Independence Day, the first one, had was imitators, not sequels. Afterwards, we had Deep Impact, we had Armageddon. I mean, it sort of changed what they called event movies of the 90s, and it really sort of set the mould. And it had a great sort of campy Roland Emmerich kind of, you know, fascism to it. It was kind of the world being destroyed, but isn't it a laugh? He did The Day After Tomorrow, then after that.
Well, he really created his own genre of movies,
yeah,
didn't he?
And I have to say, I've always quite enjoyed them. This one, 20 years on, it sort of says, well, we're going to go back to the Great War of 96, and we've had peace on the planet ever since. And I'm like thinking, well, I don't know if that's really true, to be honest. And then the aliens come again. I mean, essentially, it's just a reboot. It's the same movie again, but without Will Smith, which is the shame, because the best thing about the first movie probably was Will Smith and Bill Pullman
Why is he not in the film? Is there a particular reason given in the film that he's absent?
He's dead. Is the reason given in the film?
Oh, I see.
And he's
that's rather unfortunate.
It's just unfortunate because we don't see. I was like, did he die in the original one? No,
well,
he's a hero.
You made me doubt myself.
I know.
Just then.
His son is in it. The character's son is in it. Steve Hiller is the character. So his son Chris is in it, played by Jesse Usher. And so they do a lot of backstory to try and kind of say, well, actually, these are the kids who were the president's daughter. So Bill Pullman was the president. His daughter now works at the White House. Where she's incidentally run by a woman in this film as well, which perhaps gives you a hint where Hollywood thinks the presidential race is going. Presidents on movies can be important. I remember when Morgan Freeman played the president in Deep Impact, and everyone said that sort of paved the way for Obama. You do it on the big screen first,
so
and then life can follow. So
wondering.
It's happening first in Roland Emmerich. So Hillary Clinton can rest assured that Emmerich has predicted the future correctly there or something. It's a very humorless kind of event. I know the world is dying, but normally you need a bit of joke. Jeff Goldblum is in there. He always brings a bit of irony to it. He's the only person here who can kind of crack a joke and look at the destruction on screen, because, you know, it's that what I love about these movies is like, which city's going to get it next? London always gets it in these movies.
And
we've
true.
Been destroyed 100 times this year. London has fallen. London's been squashed. London's falling apart. London gets it again in this alien race. The Tower Bridge, the London Eye, they all go into the river. Half the world gets it. This alien ship that arrives is so big that you can't get it on screen. I mean, it's kind of pointless, because you can't. I think if you've got a monster and it's scary, show it on the screen and we can be scared. But they can only show bits of it because it's 3,500 miles across. So it kind of really defeats the object of the visual impact of this kind of scary alien thing. It's a very silly movie. Everyone's got a shortwave radio that they dust off and can kind of twiddle, and, you know, all around the world they can tune in and find out what the apocalypse is doing. I know I've got mine at home. So I didn't not enjoy it. I just found it all a very sort of shrugging exercise. I'm sure it'll do quite well, but there's a lot of backstory and plot being crammed into it where really you just want to see things being blown up.
It's so unfortunate. I mean, there was talk of a third film being dependent on this one's success, and it feels as though that probably won't happen.
No, I think you can't hold a behemoth like this back. Once unleashed, it's going to be upon us. So I think there is another one. Will the world die this time? They'll have just rebuilt it after that. I mean, every film now, the entire world is destroyed by, you know, Avengers destroy things, and there's no world left for these superheroes and aliens to destroy.
Oh dear, the appetite for big, huge, apocalyptic blockbusters may well be dying off, but you never know. That is Independence Day Resurgence, out in cinemas, well, basically everywhere. I challenge you to avoid it. To finish the show off today, we're heading to Spain to talk virtual reality. The annual Sonar Electronic Music Festival has been running for more than 20 years. The festival has transformed from a niche event into a mainstream fixture of the European scene, constantly shifting its curatorial strategy. Most recently, technological innovation has been prioritised, along with the idea of building creative communities that enrich each other's work. Virtual reality has been a hot topic at Sundance, the Sheffield Documentary Festival, and Sonar this year, so Monocle's Frederick Burness went to find out what all the fuss is about.
Since the first edition in 1994, Sonar has made its name as one of the most exciting electronic festivals in Europe, and it attracts music lovers from across the globe. This year, 150,000 visitors were expected over 3 days, but it wasn't just the eclectic lineup which drew people in. The fifth annual Sonar Plus D also took place, a parallel congress dedicated to creativity technology and business.
The artistic community is not only offering ideas from the side, it's very much on a central place in the ecosystem of innovation today, especially through its links with technology and its links with society.
That's José Luis de Vicente, curator of Sona Plasti.
Most festivals mostly show results, you know, mostly show a finished thing that is happening in front of an audience. And we are really big proponents of the idea that every single stage of the creative process can be highlighted and presented in public, you know, whether it's conceptualizing proof of concept to early stage prototypes, to the moment in which a community of creators embraces a new tool, a new technology, or a new language, to the moment that you already have something and people are looking for funding or distribution or a business model.
Another main focus was virtual reality. The Realities Plus D section featured dozens of projects which long lines of people waited to try out using VR headsets. Exhibitors from Google showcased a virtual painting game, while filmmakers and storytellers were keen to invite you into parallel worlds and immersive experiences. Allumet is a 20-minute feature about a girl and her mother who carry magic matches to a mystical cloud village in their flying ship. It was created by Penrose Studios. Founder Jimmy Maidens says he essentially had to unlearn everything he has picked up during a long career in animation production.
The hardest thing is that you're working in this 2D screen and then you put the headset on and it doesn't look anything like what you expected it to. It might look better or worse. If you have a lot of experience, you have to be ready to say, I don't know why this isn't working. People that have been in film for a long time and not willing to let go of their ideas of how a film or a narrative piece should be made, you can end up with a situation where they end up hitting brick walls, and it's like you have to figure out how to let go of that and rethink it.
The beautifully visualized piece lets you explore its fantastical landscape, peeking around corners and watching the action unfold from any angle you choose. Even though there is no spoken dialogue and the characters communicate only through sound, it was easy to follow the story, which Maidens admitted is not completely finished yet. He believes that virtual reality will have the same impact as the invention of film more than 100 years ago.
I think the general assumption is that VR is for games, but we really believe that we can create content that's just for everybody. Trying to figure out the ways to like create that language, you know, the native VR creation language, and how to understand how to do these things in VR is like a big goal of why we're doing these pieces now, as well as developing our tech and everything so that going forward, well, it'll be easier for us to create more of these worlds and content and, you know, places for you to come and just enjoy.
Others at Sona talked about using virtual reality for scientific or educational projects, or even to link people around the world in simulated social or work situations. Recent developments have made it cheaper and easier to get a headset of your own, and it feels like the future will depend on how the quality of content can match these huge strides forward in technology. The VR hype may only last until something else comes along, and perhaps the only certainty is that nothing is really certain at all. But one other thing is for sure, Sona Plus D will stay true to its experimental mantra, and the results should be fascinating. For Monocle, in Barcelona, I'm Frederick Bernas.
Thanks to Frederick Bernas for that report from Sonar, and thanks to my guest here in the studio today, Jason Solomons. You've been listening to The Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Ryland. Don't forget to tune in to The Cinema Show later today. That's at 20:00 London time, where we'll be having a chat to, of course, the star of Remainder, Asher Ali, and the director of Sabura, Stefano Salima, and the star of that film too, Pier Francesco Favino. This show was produced by Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time on Monday, where we'll be talking art. But for now, from me in the studio, thanks very much for listening. Bye for now.